Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 10th, aught 10, and this is show number 240. I tell you, it was so hard getting back into the grind at work this week. Took 3 weeks off and then had to work 5 whole days in a row. It was horrible. Not once did a nice cabana boy come by and offer me a nice smoothie when I was at work either. I'm telling you, it was gruesome. I don't know, I think in the big picture, vacation is bad for you because it lets you know what not working feels like. And that's just a big old tease because we don't get to pick that. I wonder if Steve would let me quit and just let him go to work. Yeah, right. All I can dream, can't I? All right, let's get into some tech. Here's a story for you all about Dell. You know, Dell has a great customer service reputation, right? That's what I thought too. Here's the story. On November 17th, I ordered a monitor from Dell online for Kyle's birthday. It was a month later on December 18th, so I gave him a full month to deliver this to me. Now, I didn't really track it too closely because I was ordering so much stuff online. I was pretty mellow about this order because I had a full month for it to get there. About 3 weeks went by and I got an email from Dell telling me of a delay, which would miss Kyle's birthday. Oh well, you know, stuff happens, right? I figured I'd just give it to him for Christmas. And then I got a second delay notice, still with no explanation of why. Finally, I got a third delay notice on December 1st, telling me it wouldn't even get there till January. They said in this notice, and I am quoting directly from the notice, "Contact us today to let us know that you still want us to ship this order, though it will arrive later than expected. See the revised estimated delivery date below. If we do not receive permission, the order will automatically be canceled within 24 hours. So I figured I'd just abandon this whole track and go to a brick-and-mortar store. So I did not respond to their email, and I assumed they would cancel as they promised they would. Well, Christmas came and went. Kyle was delighted with his new 24-inch monitor from the brick-and-mortar store, and all was good. Then on January 1st, Steve went out to take down our Christmas lights. I got to explain briefly the layout of our yard for you to understand how absurd the situation is. As you face the house, on the left-hand side is the driveway. If you walk up the driveway, on the left is a gate that leads to kind of a paved side hallway thingy with stuff like, there's a wood pile, you know, for the fire. Yeah, I know, it does get down into like the 40s on occasion around here, so we've been known to make a fire in the fireplace. But anyway, it's a very obvious gate that you would walk up to. It would be very reasonable to walk in there. On the right-hand side, though, there's a lawn. Okay, it's postage stamp size because it's California, but there's a lawn with a big tree in it, has branches hanging down, so you have to duck under it if you want to walk back there. There's kind of some shrubs along the right-hand side and shrubs up against the house. If you were to walk across the grass, duck down under the branches of the tree, then walk between the shrubs on some little tiny stepping stones, you would find another gate. There's nothing back there but a shed blocking the way. In fact, it's so unused, the gate on the right was actually broken for about 5 years, and it didn't have any impact on our lives because who would ever go back there? We only recently had a new gate put in. So anyway, back to New Year's Day. Steve's up on a ladder, remember it's January 1st, and he's taking down the lights, and he happens to glance over the gate on the right, and he sees a box from Dell sitting behind the gate. You've got to be kidding me. I couldn't believe it. They delivered the monitor. They did not leave a note on the door. They did not send me an email telling me they'd shipped it either. I looked online, and they shipped it out about 3 days after they said they were canceling it. That means it was sitting outside for about 3.5 weeks. Now, under normal circumstances in California, that wouldn't be that big of a deal, but it turns out that it did actually rain in Southern California during that month. So I was so annoyed I was going to have to deal with this, but, you know, I'm 100% certain Dell is just going to take care of me, right? So I call up the customer service number, and after navigating an absurd menu structure, I finally get to a human. She listened to my story and then quite snippily explained to me that I should have read the terms and conditions much more clearly because they do clearly state that any returns must be within 30 days and that they would be unable to give me my money back. Seriously? She, of course, had no idea who she was dealing with, the poor dear. I suggested she give me her supervisor, and she tried to give me some more rhetoric. I asked again for her supervisor, louder this time because she clearly did not catch it the first time. Well, anyway, a few more repetitions of this sequence, and she finally got my point. The manager received my message a tad more quickly, but he was still quite snippy about the whole thing, saying things like, well, as a one-time deal, we'll let you send it back to us. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about, a one-time deal? If you're going to deliver something to me, you better tell me you had delivered it and put it someplace where I'd know the heck where it was. You hid it from me. Anyway, as I was telling Bart this story, he said, not only should they not have been snippy, they ought to have been offering apologies for any inconvenience to me, not treating me like some lowlife they scraped off the bottom of their shoe. Anyway, I'm not sure what the lesson is, but I did enjoy telling you guys the story, so thank you for letting me vent. I've mentioned quite a few times that I'm not really a big tagger. You know, I don't tag my photos. I simply name them. I name my files, too. But anyway, you'll find it odd then that I asked the folks over at gravityapps.com if I could test their application called Tags. Well, we got to start with a problem to be solved, right? Well, the problem is that we receive and create information in so many different ways now, we can't really keep it all in one place and sort it like we did in the old days. We used to be able to manage folders and files within them, but there's so much darn stuff now that it's just not possible. It's in all these different sources. We've got emails, we create documents, we store photos in photo libraries, we find websites, and we need to manage all this stuff. Sometimes they all have something to do with each other. The idea behind tags is that you can tag everything. Then you can find things that all have something in common, but come from different sources. That sounds kind of boring, but if I give you an example, I think you'll get the idea. Let's say you're planning a trip to Macworld Expo. You've got the email from the airlines confirming your plane tickets. You've got the MacworldExpo.com website. You've got a PDF of your hotel reservations. You've got people you want to meet up with at the expo who are over in your address book. Say, an Excel document where you've written down all of the events you want to go to. How do you keep all this information together when they're in all these disparate places and applications? With tags, you can organize and access all of these items. Well, let's walk through first how easy it is to tag things. First of all, the default keystroke to invoke tags is control space. In the Finder, click a file, control space, and then type in the tag you want to use and hit enter. Repeat until you've got all the tags you want, and then click save on the window that's popped up. Navigate then, say, to a URL in Safari, control space, add the tags as before. I should mention tags only work in Safari, not with any other browser, which is kind of a bummer, because I use Firefox and Chrome too, and I'm not always in Safari. If you're in address book, select a contact, control space, type in your tag, and hit save. Found the email from your airlines and Apple Mail? Control space, enter your tags. Starting to see a pattern here? All right, so all this tagging is only useful if you can actually use the tags to find what you need. Open tags by launching the program, or by a simple control space with or without anything selected. And in the upper right, you'll see a magnifying glass. Clicking it will flip over the application, and as you start typing the tag name, it auto-fills it in for you. I typed in MW2010, and I could see my documents for Macworld Expo, a link to the Macworld Expo website, and an email with Steve and my press badges included. Now, I was reasonably pleased with tags at this point. It did exactly what it said it would do, and it did it well and pretty easily. Then I discovered the Tag Manager. I was worried that tags would get so full of tags that I couldn't easily find the ones I wanted in this giant list of tags I might make up. In the Tag Manager, it turns out you can choose certain tags and declare them to be favorites. Now, let's stick with our MW2010 tag. Once I'd selected it as a favorite, now when I go to tag an item, it shows MW2010 in the favorites list, so I can just click on that instead of guessing exactly how did I write that tag, you know, trying to type it the same way each time. It's right there, very, very accessible. In the Tag Manager, you can rename tags and remove tags too. If you click on a tag in the left sidebar of the Tag Manager, you can see the list of items that are tagged with that name. There's also a Quick Look button. That's really cool because you can click on a tagged item and get a look at it just to bring it up quickly, verify it's the right file you're looking for. Double-clicking on a file name in the Tag Manager actually opens the file. So by now, I'm really getting the hang of this tag thing, starting to see how useful it could be. Then I discovered another button in the Tag Manager. It's called Make New Smart Folder. So I clicked on the MW2010 tag, made a new smart folder, and now, in the left sidebar of every Finder window where smart folders go, that's the little section that says search for, I can see a folder containing all of my MW2010 items. Perfect. Now, that wouldn't really be that extraordinary because smart folders are built into OS X, but think about the fact that these items I'm now seeing in the Finder are not all Finder documents. Some are web links and other non-Finder-ish documents. Well, I did have one problem with tags, but first I should mention at this point that I was working with a beta version. I tagged Steve in my address book, and while he does show up in the tag manager, the smart folder does not show his contact information. I also can see my email about the press badges in the tag manager, but it's not showing up in the smart folder either. However, the web location that I tagged does show up in the smart folder. I sent a note over to Nicholas at gravityapps.com and wanted to let him know about this problem so they could get it fixed before they come out of beta. This is what I love about shareware developers in general and the Gravity Apps people in particular. His response to me sending in this bug was, "Thank you so much for helping us develop this product. That's fantastic." It was just so nice. I love that, you know. No snippiness from Gravity Apps, I can tell you that. Well, one thing that isn't intuitive about tags for me, if I type in a tag or tags on an item, it seems natural to just close the tags window. But if you do that, it didn't actually tag it. You have to hit apply, and then that will close the window and save the tag. I don't know if that's just me or a usability thing that maybe needs to be adjusted, but that wasn't completely intuitive to me. Can't tell you how many times I just closed the window and then later on realized that my work had been for naught. All right, bottom line time. If you like tagging to organize the incredibly varied piles of information we're all flooded with now, then I think you'd really like tags. It's easy to use, has some really nice organization tools, especially the smart folder option. Now, tags is $29. Seems a little bit steep to me. I guess I'd expect that to be more in the $15, $20 range for this kind of utility. Now, don't get me wrong, it's very well done, but for a single-use utility, it seems a little highly priced. I do enjoy the functionality of tags, and we'll see over time if I've turned into a tagging fiend. I have a feeling I might. If you're into tags, go check out tags at gravityapps.com. You've heard me yapping about Screen Steps for ages now, the fantastic documentation tool that makes creating lessons and manuals for online activities fun rather than drudgery. One of the many cool features of Screen Steps is its ability to let you upload lessons to your blog. I've used it a ton of times for the tutorials you can get over at podfeet.com, and that's using WordPress. But what if you use Blogger or Google Sites to create your blog? With the newly released Screen Steps 2.7.1, you can now upload to Blogger with either a standard or pro version of Screen Steps, or you can upload to Google Sites if you have the pro version of Screen Steps. I put a couple of links in the show notes to some quick tutorials on how to use Screen Steps with these blogging tools. Of course, the lessons were created using Screen Steps. If you haven't bought Screen Steps yet, head over to screensteps.com and be sure to use my promo code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off the purchase price of Screen Steps Standard or Pro. Once you try it, you'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Seriously, I'm not kidding. It's that life-changing. Do you remember the days when having a Mac was something to apologize for? Second-class citizen doesn't begin to describe it. Well, I'm loving these days. Even though the Mac is still a small minority, we're getting the respect, you know? When a company like TechSmith creates a version of Camtasia that's not some bad, lame port of the Windows version, but instead an elegant new application that's very Mac-like, it just warms the cockles of my heart. It's a cockle anyway. Well, anyway, TechSmith has done it again. They've come out with the Mac version of their very popular screen capture software, Snagit. Now, for some reason that escapes me right now, I never ever use Snagit for Windows, but I've heard great things about it over the years. So I looked with fresh eyes on the beta version of Snagit for the Mac. Now, I haven't talked about screen capture utilities for ages, but I've used all of them, I think. But the reigning champion on the Mac for me has been Sketch from Sketch.com for a very, very long time. Sketch is easy to launch, easy to take screen snapshots with their, you know, rectangular crosshairs. You can do some fairly rudimentary annotation. You've got text with lots of font, shadow kind of options, arrows. You know, you can change the size of the arrows and double versus single-ended, that sort of thing. You've got rectangles and ovals, all with color and thickness options. Finally, you can drag from the window to the Finder or to an FTP client like Transmit. Or you can click Share, and they give you a web link you can email out. Now, this last bit is crucial for things like Twitter and, say, news groups that don't allow attachments. All right, enough about Sketch, but I wanted to give you a baseline first of what I would be comparing to. Snagit by default hides on the side of your monitor with a tiny little tab to bring it forward. It defaults to what they call all-in-one capture, but you can also choose plain old window capture. The beauty of all-in-one capture is you can drag across an area, or you can hover over a window and Snagit will capture just that window. It's brilliant how it chooses the window. It'll even choose one that's partially hidden behind another and take the picture. It's a cool capability to be able to choose live while you're capturing, decide how you want to capture. Now, it's not uncommon to want to capture a window that you have to scroll to see the whole thing. Let's say you're in Firefox and you want to be able to capture a whole long window, like my entire blog posting. Well, it turns out there's a Firefox extension that comes with the installer called Auto Scroll Helper for Firefox. If you install the Auto Scroll Helper extension, when you hover over a Firefox window, you got the highlight to tell you it's getting that entire window, but you also get a double arrow scroller thingy down at the bottom of the window, and if you click that little thingy, you get a capture of the entire window no matter how long it is. I found that this worked in some applications other than Firefox. For example, it worked in Feeder too. So if you play around with it, it's worth experimenting with your applications to see which ones work. You can also set Snagit to take snapshots with a delay after capturing. You can choose from 1, 3, 5, or 10 seconds. This is enormously useful if you want to capture pull-down menus, for example. I really wish Sketch had this. While I was playing around with Snagit, I noticed a little grayscale notice in the bottom that said H for help. That was kind of nice. I clicked H, and up came a little grayscale help thing, and then I clicked H again, and it disappeared. Kind of cool. Let's get into the annotation features, because this is where Snagit really rocks. Remember the arrows in Sketch? Well, with Snagit, you can actually grab the middle of an arrow and stretch it into an arc. Arc not enough? Every time you bend an arrow, it gives you a new point to change the shape of the arrow. Basically, infinite possibilities. You have solid arrows, dashes, you can change the length of the dashes, the colors, all easy peasy with Snagit. For all elements of annotation, they have an unusual shadow menu. I put a screenshot of it in the show notes because it's this odd little grid where you click around in 9 different places to control the angle of the shadow. Not quite sure why there's 9 of them, but there are. It's an odd little menu, but it works very intuitively. It actually works well. I think my favorite part of annotating images with Snagit is the thought bubbles. They're perfectly normal, but you can add a second tail to the thought bubble. And you can drag both tails all around the thought bubble, and it's perfectly smooth as you drag them around. I don't think I'm doing justice to this, but it's really fun to go, wee, and you whip the little tail around, and the whole thing's changing shape as you go. All right, well, it entertained me at least. I showed it to the chat room, and I think my favorite comment was Kevin, otherwise known as Big in Virginia, said, "It's easier to entertain us old people." Well, this is a point at which you realize that you can pretty much do whatever you want in Snagit. There's 8 different thought bubbles, but within each one of those, you can change the foreground and background colors, the fonts, the shadow, the line style, line width. All of this is changeable. You can control layers, too. You can move annotations forward and back at your whim. And it's pretty much non-destructive editing while you're working on it. Now, there's a teaser tab called Effects. I wish I knew what that was, but all it says is coming soon. Apparently, this is a feature that's on the Windows version, so maybe I'll have to try that Windows version out and see what it is. Whatever effects are, I'm sure I want it and I need it badly, so they better do it right away. Well, anyway, often when I do a screenshot, I realize that someone else's email address is showing, or maybe there's an AIM name I really didn't want to show. With Snagit, you have a tool to just blur a region. That's very handy. I really like the blur tool. There's pencil and eraser tools too, but they didn't really blow my dress up. The eraser only erases the bitmap background. It can't affect the layers above that, so I'm not really sure why that's all that helpful. Maybe after you flatten the image, it might be useful, but I couldn't really think of a use case for it. One of the features I love about Sketch is its ability to do a nice drop shadow on the screenshot. Basically, every image you see on podfeet.com has been processed through Sketch so that it's nicely set off against the white background of my website. While Snagit has this amazing shadow control, remember the 9-quadranted thing that let me change the shadows? That works only on the elements of an image. I couldn't find a way to add a shadow to the entire background, the entire image before exporting it. Maybe it's in there, but I didn't find it. Remember how I said I liked with Skitch you could click share and it would put your image up on the web and then you could just share the link? With Snagit, the only share option is to send an email, or you can copy and then paste it into a document or email. I tried dragging and dropping to the desktop, but unfortunately it created a Snagit project file instead of a JPEG or a PNG. If I flattened the image first, it created a picture clipping file. I've never really been clear what those picture clipping files are even for. It's unfortunate they don't have any other options for export, but I bet that's something that's coming before the release, because remember, this is a beta product at this point, and they also make the free product Jing, which does have an export to the web option. In taking a screenshot, one tricky bit is getting a precise selection, getting that exact edge of the window you want. Snagit has a beautiful solution for this. As you hover to get ready to grab one corner, a magnifier comes up showing pixel-level detail, so you can grab that precise corner you wanted. Excellent feature. All right, time for the bottom line, don't you think? Overall, I'm loving Snagit, even though it has some bugs in the beta version, but they have a forum for reporting the issues, so I'm pretty confident that the folks at TechSmith will clean these things up. Here's the one downside I see. Snagit for the PC is $50. If they set the Mac version that high, I don't see how I could recommend it. You know, Skitch doesn't have the rich feature set and all these options for annotations, but it is actually free. They also have the Jing project, as I mentioned before, at jingproject.org, I think. Anyway, that's also free and has some of the capability and does have that web export. The effects of Snagit are far superior to Skitch, but $50 better? Maybe $20 sounds more like it to me. I'm starting to sound cheap on the show, aren't I? Well, anyway, they haven't priced it yet, and the good news is that you can join the beta for Snagit for the Mac yourself and make your own decision. Check it out at techsmith.com/snagitmac. Santa from santasimage.com sent in the oddest thing I've ever gotten for an audio podcast. He sent in a visible review. Yeah, I know that sounds kind of goofy, but when has that ever gotten in our way? I'll describe it, but the picture in the show notes is essentially the entire review. It's a picture of a FireWire 800 9-pin to 6-pin adapter. It's a combination photo of the packaging from a company called SIG, S-I-I-G, and the adapter itself sitting in what looks like a small saucer, the kind that goes under a teacup. I believe the purpose of this is to illustrate to us how small this little adapter is. Here's his entire content of the review. It works. Now the FireWire cord on the cinema display can plug into the Mac Mini, MacBook, etc. Now it's not entirely clear to me why you'd want to do this, but evidently this was a critical need for Santa. I did push him far enough to get a link for the show notes to actually buy the adapter. He got it from Newegg for $10.95 plus shipping. I checked it out and it looks like it's $13 through the US store. Well, thanks, Santa, for the visual review for an audio podcast. And now, a word from our sponsor, brought to you courtesy of Justin Byrne of the MacCrack podcast, hosted at maccrack.com.
Do your headlights need tweaking? Does your box jam when you shift your stick? Are you having trouble with your horn? Or do you have a bug in your bonnet? If your answer to any of the above is yes, and you drive a Honda or Acura and live in the LA or Orange County areas, then you need to call Honda Bob on 562-531-2321 or email him at hdabob@aol.com. He's great with his hands. Honda Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
Well, it's that time of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartb.ie. How are you this fine Saturday night?
Well, it's night for me, morning for you, and it's very, very cold for me.
Yeah, I gotta say, the weather in Europe and other parts of the United States it's just taken the fun out of gloating about our weather. It's supposed to be in the high 70s today, but I can't look at the weather and just really enjoy that, torturing you guys about it this time.
Well, yesterday we had a daytime high of -2.
Yikes.
Followed by a winter low of a nighttime low of -13.
Yikes. That's not normal for you guys, right?
No, no. Our houses are not built for it. I had frost on the inside of my windows.
Oh, jeez. See, you put a link to a picture in the show notes about the weather, right?
I did. Yeah, it's a satellite image. I just love the fact that we live in the space age and you can get this. But the BBC released it, and I think it's from the British Met Office. It is a photograph. Now, it's centred on the UK because it was the BBC, but it is the whole of England from the very tip of Cornwall to Land's End, way up in Scotland. Actually, I can never remember whether Land's End is the top or the bottom of England. One of them is John O'Groats, one of them is Land's End. Anyway, from top to bottom, it is pure white. And next to it, somewhat cloud-covered, is a mostly white Ireland. The whitest bit being along the east coast, which is where I live.
Holy cow. Now, I'm looking at it. Now, forgive me, my geography. You guys are to the right of England, right?
Left.
Left. Okay. Well, there you go.
Closer to you.
Near the top or the bottom of this picture, because there is a lot of clouds.
Okay. Right. So you can see that, let me see, you can see the Isle of Man sitting in the Irish Sea. It's
yes.
The only island sitting in the Irish Sea.
Right.
So if you go down from that, you meet C-shaped bay, and then straight across from that is Ireland's east coast.
Oh, there you go. And you can see some green on Ireland, but not on the east side of it.
Yeah, that green is to the west, and that's not snow. That's where they had black ice instead.
Jeez. I will not gloat this week, I promise.
On the other hand, I mean, it's been very pretty. Last night, as I was freezing, I wasn't entirely sure it was fun anymore, but it has been pretty.
Reminds me of a time we were skiing in Lake Tahoe, and it was just coming down like crazy. It was just snowing like mad. And this guy we were with said, wow, this would be really fun if we were warm and dry.
I have to say now, I've taken to wearing two coats at once, and that way I'm actually fine.
Would you believe Steve bought me what I believe is my second coat in my adult life?
Wow.
Like, not counting ski wear that I used to wear when I used to ski, but my second coat for wearing around, like, town, you know?
And how often does it get worn? Once a decade?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, my other coat, I probably haven't worn it in 10 years.
Well, see, what's really unusual for Ireland here is that there's no thaw during the day. We're used to having weeks and weeks on end of frost at night and then thaw during the day and then freeze again and then thaw and then freeze again. What we're not used to is being no thaw. So it's actually just layering up. Because there's a photo. I sent you some photographs for the show notes, and one of them is taken on our street. It's white. That's 2 days after the snow fell. The cars have not managed to get down to anything remotely termicadam coloured.
Wow.
It's compacted snow on top of ice, on top of more ice.
Well, hey, people are going to accuse us of doing this week in weather, so we better get into the show. But we'll come back to those photos.
Well, actually, no, we won't, because they're... Well, we might. No, they were only meant for the intro, to be honest.
There you go.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
All right, so we have a mashup here. This is just crazy. We have Security Light meets Dumb Question Corner.
Ooh.
Why don't you kick it off?
I hate reading.
Oh, okay. So Pam in Seattle wrote in a security question that she called a dumb question, so I thought it'd be fun to have Bart answer this one. She says, I have a dumb question. I've been using Back to My Mac to access my air disk on my time capsule. Is this secure enough to make Bart happy? I'm doing everything on this support page, and she gave the support.apple.com link. Mm-hmm. She says, I love it when you and Bart talk Security Light. I admit that I'm getting behind on podcasts. I can't listen to spoken word when I'm writing code, but I don't see where you and Bart have talked about this recently. If you have, then please forgive me. So first of all, no forgiveness required. We have not talked about this.
Yeah, exactly. This is all new topic.
Explain to us what she's doing, because I don't actually follow this.
Right, your time capsule is where it all begins, is a router / wireless access point, and it contains a hard disk. And not only does it contain a hard disk, it contains a USB port into which you can plug another hard disk.
Okay, right.
And when you do that, that second hard disk is referred to as an air disk.
Oh, so the one that's inside is not a regular hard drive?
It's not called an air disk. That's just the time capsule itself. I think a lot of Apple's routers let you plug in an external drive, even ones that don't have a drive in them themselves. So Apple call it air disk because it's a wireless hard drive, effectively.
I should do that. I have an AirPort Extreme with a USB port. I could do that.
There you go. You can have an air disk. Sounds cool.
And then I could back to my Mac on it. All right.
Yeah. So then what she's doing is she's using Back to My Mac to access this disk in her house, when she's away from home so she can get at her files, which is actually, I think, fine. Because Back to My Mac is just a cleverly disguised VPN.
Oh.
So what it does is it stops you having to remember what your address is and any of that kind of stuff. And anytime you log into your any of your computers, they just send a little message back to Apple server saying, hello, this is now my IP address. Look at me, I'm over here. And then when you need to talk back to your Mac, you simply say, so where's my machine? And OS X behind the scenes goes, hello, Mr. Apple server, where's that machine gone? Oh, it's over there. Okay, I'll connect to it. And it just sets up a VPN tunnel between, you know, where you are away and your home machine. And then in you go and off you go.
Okay. So she's in good shape.
She's in good shape, but the only potential point of weakness is that the only thing protecting you is your password. So the only authentication protecting you is your password. So make sure you have a good password on your .Mac. Or so mobile me, sorry.
How many characters long is a good password again? 172 or something?
That would be very good. I grant you that. It's more important, if they're 8 long is probably enough, but it's very important just to get a nice mix of letters, numbers, symbols, and upper and lower case.
Okay.
That's probably the big thing. And whatever you do, don't use a word that's in a dictionary.
I remember reading a hacker book where they talked about the earliest hacking, where that was just all they did was take a dictionary, map it against it, go, okay, there's your password. I'm good.
Yeah. They've expanded things a bit. So you have like what they still call them dictionaries, but you can download if you want to attack people, you know, Star Trek dictionaries, if you know they're a Star Trek fan, and, you know, Babylon 5 dictionaries and God knows what dictionaries. So dictionary word isn't just the Oxford English Dictionary. It is also, you know, TV show names, character names. That would all count as dictionary words.
Actually, I bet what would work is something like gardening terms, because, you know, what kind of geeks would ever think of that? Right. Names of flowers and stuff like that.
Take out a few vowels, replace them with a few numbers, letify it, and you're probably in good shape.
All right. Well, that's good to know. So thanks, Pam, for the dumb question like that. So we do have some security light. You're back off holiday?
I'm off RSS holiday now. I haven't been as diligent as usual because, well, this country is not designed to deal with snow. So basically almost no one was in work and the place was just chaos. But since I live locally, I was in.
So you had to work.
Yeah. So no, it was total chaos.
Was and school then we in had, session?
Yeah, we have exams on and the exams are going ahead. And students are highly unhappy.
Oh, I bet.
Wow. But yeah, so yeah, it's been hectic, so I haven't been entirely up to date, but there's nothing of import on US cert, which really? Tells me there's nothing catastrophically earth-shattering, so that's good. We have a little catch-up to do from a few weeks ago. There was another, I lose track of how many of these there have been, another major flaw in Adobe's PDF products on affecting all platforms, Linux, Unix, and Mac. Don't use Adobe's junk.
Just really, take it off.
Yeah, I how many times did we say that in 2009? You know, zero-day exploit in Adobe's PDF products.
Now, you wouldn't extend that all the way to Photoshop, right? You're saying that all the PDF crap.
Well, so far, Photoshop seems not to be suffering so horribly from all of these flaws, yeah. But certainly their PDF products and their Flash products, they make Microsoft, even in the worst days of Microsoft, look good.
Yikes.
Yeah, not good. Anyway, speaking of Microsoft...
They've been well behaved, though, right?
They have, yes. We got advanced notification of the patch Tuesday for January. A whopping one bug.
No.
Yeah.
That's because they were all on vacation, and so were the hackers, right?
Actually, hackers come out of vacation, and everyone else goes on vacation. Oh. All of those networks sitting there connected to the internet with no sysadmins. Heaven for them. Just one bulletin. It's for Windows. It's rated critical for Windows 2000 and low priority for everything else.
Wow. I wonder how much Windows 2000 is still out there.
I think it's just Win2K server, and I don't think you can even license it anymore for anything else. But a lot of server stuff. At work, we would have old applications that are still on Win2K server.
Yeah, but you got to get off of those.
Very hard.
Oh, yeah.
As soon as you have vendors involved, it all just goes downhill.
Right. Well, good on them then for still patching it, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is one of their enterprise products, so I guess that's why.
Yeah.
There was also a new version of Firefox, 3.5.7, if you're counting. Not a security update, though. Just a bug fix.
Oh.
The previous one, which is not that long before, I don't remember the exact date, but it wasn't a million years ago, was 3.5.6. which was late December sometime, and that was a security update. So if your Firefox is still on 3.54, you definitely need to, 3.55, you need to go up to 3.56 at least. But you should go to 3.57.
I had a question on that. If you do the standard install of Firefox at 3.5 or higher, I believe it defaults to updating itself.
Firefox has done that for years.
No.
I think they even 3.0 did that. The 1 series didn't. I'm not sure about the 1.5 series, and I thought the 2 series did it as well.
No, I don't think they do. The 3.0 series would not upgrade itself to 3.5.
Yeah, no, it won't jump branches. None of them ever jumped branches.
Right.
So 1.5 you could have would never get you to 2.
But you could have a 3.0 version that was insecure, and it wouldn't take you up to 3.5 to be secure.
Well, the 3.0 and the 3.5 branch are different code bases, so just because there's a flow in 3.5.4 doesn't mean there's a flow in 3.0 anything.
Right. So is there a secure version of 3.0?
If memory serves, 3.0 ends support in January.
Yeah, so...
Now-ish. So I think if you're on 3.0, it's time for 3.5.
I remember the earlier versions telling me to upgrade, but 3.5 does it for you. You're just sitting there doodling along and it'll go, reboot, because I just upgraded.
Oh, maybe that's what's changed. But yeah, you were never left in any sort of doubt that there was action to be taken.
Correct. But you could be an idiot and not do it. And now you can't, unless you undo
it tells you afterwards,
Right. Unless you undo the defaults, which you can change. You can say, don't do that for me. But I kind of like that because most of us are idiots, you know?
I used to have issues with it, but I don't like it when Windows reboots your machine behind your back. But this is somewhat different because it just puts a little message in just to let you know that's been done. Yeah. Say, okay.
And next time you update, all of a sudden everything's become new.
Shiny. Yeah.
That's good. So relatively quiet while you were on RSS holiday. That's good to know.
Yes.
Let's get into some fun. Get into some candy now. What's up?
Yeah, I snuck in a topic because basically all I've been doing the last couple of weeks is taking pictures of stuff that's white, i.e. snow or frost or whatever, because really that's all that's been available. So I thought maybe since the whole of Europe is in the grip of a mini ice age, it might be time to discuss taking pictures of all the winter beauty.
Oh, yeah.
So I just put together a few quick tips from my experiences over the last couple of days. The biggest tip, shoot raw. Your camera is going to be confused by snow. There's just no two ways about it. So a little bit of wiggle room will do you the world of good.
Oh, good. Good to know. I just finally switched mine to RAW so I'd stop arguing with you.
Woohoo!
By the way, could you buy me a new disk drive?
Well, there is a reason my Aperture library is on an external drive.
I think mine's over 80 gigabytes now, so...
Yeah, but extra little passport drives will get up to 500 gigs or something, I think.
That's true. I don't do that, though. I keep it on my internal drive so far.
Yeah, you'll grow out of it eventually.
Yeah.
My MacBook Pro has an 80 gig internal drive with 30 gigs worth of iTunes stuff. That ruled out my photo being there.
See, not having iTunes music, that really helps me.
I have audiobooks, like squillions. I have all of the Harry Potters unabridged.
Oh, wow.
Which is a lot of Harry Potter. And I have all of the His Dark Materials unabridged. And I have all of... Anyway, let's not go down that road. I love audiobooks.
All right, what's the next tip?
So, if at all, you should really be using a mode that allows you to dial in exposure compensation. I don't think full auto does that. But Program, which is close to full auto, should allow you to do it. And aperture priority is probably a good bet.
So you're talking about where you go like plus or minus one and halves and stuff?
Yeah,
that little
and
dialer.
It's going to be plus.
I'm not sure I have figured out how to do that on the D40. I used to know how to do it on my Minolta.
If you look at the D40, there's a plus minus button right next to the trigger.
Yeah?
You hold that down and you use the thumb wheel at the back and you can dial in.
But then you have to look through the viewfinder to see it. It's not on the display, is it?
It is on the display.
Oh, okay.
It shows up at the bottom of the display. The indicator for it's only there if you have some dialed in.
Okay. All right.
Aperture priority is probably a good choice. There's an old adage, you know, the secret to a good photograph is F8 and be there. So if you're not used to shooting an aperture priority, you're not really sure where to put the f-stop, F8.
I love advice like that. I can do that.
Yeah, F8 and be there. The be there part's actually much harder than the F8 part.
What's the be there? What do you mean? Be where the cool stuff to take photographs is?
Yeah.
Okay. You can't sit in your house and get it to work.
If you are going to be dialing in exposure compensation, it's going to be about plus one to top. So plus one EV.
So basically the camera will automatically underexpose the photographs when you're on...
What a light meter tries to do, your average scene should be 18% grey to look right. But a snow scene is not an average scene, so the camera will say, oh, must get it down to 18% grey, which means it's going to be underexposed.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not 18% grey, it's 90% white. So really, it's a good idea to have your camera set to show the blinkies when you overexpose and just keep dialing up that compensation until just before it starts blinking.
Oh, so what you mean by the blinkies is when you have the display, you can set it where it shows you when you're overexposed or...
Yeah, and it blinks the bits that have been blown out. So keep dialing in more and more compensation until you get blinkies and then dial back one.
You know, I've had more people who get Nikon cameras ask me, why is this blinking? Let's go here, click, and they're like, ooh, thank you.
You shouldn't turn it off, though. You should always have the blinkies on so you know what you're doing.
Oh, you know, that's like your black point blinky thing and hot and cold point blinky thing in aperture.
Yeah,
that drives me nuts.
Yeah, if the photograph's exposed, right.
Oh, but I took 560 photographs in Mexico. I'm not going to adjust all of those. That takes too much energy.
Then delete them. Anywho, before
okay,
we get
sorry,
sidetracked
sorry,
into our
little
own
cousin, you don't get to be pictured. All right. Sorry.
The other thing you may want to do, especially if you have not taken the advice to shoot RAW, is manually set your white balance, because it is going to confuse, your camera is going to be confused, and you're going to have either blue snow, which is bad, or yellow snow, which is worse.
You know, I don't think I've ever set the white balance on my Nikon. I used to on other little goofy ones, you know, little point and shoots and stuff like that, but I don't think I've ever done it on this.
I have mine pretty much welded to daylight, because 99.9% of the time, that's what I shoot in. And then on the odd occasion where I go indoors, I dial it to incandescent or fluorescent, depending on what the light source is. It just makes editing so much easier, because that auto white balance often gets awfully confused. And in snow, it will get confused, and you'll probably end up with blue snow is much more likely.
Okay.
So set it manually to daylight, which is the little sunshine icon on most cameras, and that'll be about right. If you're a little bit off, when you're post-processing, take the little eyedropper for setting the white balance and drop it on the snow, and you'll have perfect white snow.
There you go. Well, won't RAW just fix that for me anyway? I mean, if I'm in RAW, then I can use that?
If you're in RAW, then you can use the eyedropper to correct even massive incorrect or white balances, but it's a lot more work to fix something that is way off, because you just have way more sliding to do on sliders, whereas if it's nearly right, it's very simple.
Okay.
If you're using JPEG and you have to go a long way with the eyedropper, it will ruin the quality of your photograph, because the camera threw away all the data for that other white balance.
Okay.
Because it only kept the data for the white balance the camera was set to, because that's how you get a JPEG out of a RAW. Something to watch out for is your battery life is going to be lower than you expect, because batteries do not like the cold.
Oh, I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, so if you have a spare one, bring it along, keep it in your pocket, keep it warm, and keep yourself warm. That's the biggest piece of advice. There's nothing worse than being cold while you're out there and uncomfortable.
And then you won't be there.
Then you won't be there,
inside.
Yeah. I was out there, I think I went out about noon. I said, I'll just go for a quick spin because the canal looks nice. Actually, one of the photographs that's going to be in the show notes is like a path and then a big white thing. That white thing is the canal.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. It's frozen solid and snowed over. So it's just a big white thing. It looks like a road, but that's the canal.
My goodness.
I was out there from about 12 o'clock until about 4 o'clock, and I was just fine and toasty warm because, like I said, I had my two jackets on, I had a hat, glove, and scarf, and, you know, I was comfortable out there. And I had really good fun mountain biking around in the snow. Mountain bikes love snow. Or I love mountain biking in snow. It's great, as long as it's not ice, but snow is cool.
How fun.
There's a picture of my well-snowed mountain bike is in the show notes as well.
Excellent.
Anywho.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. So now we know how to photograph Christmas trees and snow.
Very wintry, Ian.
In March, we'll be covering flowers and butterflies.
If you want to, actually, I'm quite happy to keep seasonally relevant photo advice as a regular.
Oh, actually, I do. I like that idea, definitely.
Excellent. We shall continue then, and rain will be on the menu for the summer.
how to photograph in rain, stay indoors.
Under bridges, bring a brolly.
Point it to the window.
I've actually taken photos while having an umbrella crooked under my arm.
Oh, jeez.
Keep it balanced up there and then taking pictures.
Oh, my goodness.
Not ideal, though. Anyway, we have a main topic.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we're finally up to the main topic 20 minutes later. So can I do the setup for this one?
Yeah, by all means.
So last week on the show, we sort of obliquely referred to this, but I believe you said some guy called into Leo Laporte's Twitch show and went...
Yeah, apologies, Don. I'm going to regret that one.
Some guy made a video where he was talking about, they were asking what's the most important thing in the decade, and this some guy was Don McAllister, and he said that he thought RSS was the most important thing in the decade. And, you know, obviously you and I would probably agree with that immediately, but then became kind of a debate. And you and I were kind of debating on exactly what Leo and Kevin Rose said about it.
Yeah, I was surprised by the negative tone. I'm not exactly sure the exact word said, but the response was not, yes, you're dead right, Don, which is, I think, the appropriate response.
Mm.
Leo's response was, but RSS is dead.
Yeah, and I
Which
think what
people
he
then
actually
out,
said. Yeah, okay.
Well, no, he said, my memory isn't great, so maybe I'm completely wrong here. But as I remember, he basically said it was dead, and people went, wait a minute, it's in the background and stuff. And he went, yeah, I suppose.
Right. So, you know, obviously none of us would have been listening to the podcast where this happened if RSS was not there.
There's an interesting irony. Yeah, I've never heard Leo if Leo was right.
Right. So RSS is really simple syndication, which is a method of delivery, like delivering a magazine, you deliver a podcast, you deliver a text feed, that sort of thing. So taking podcasting out of it, I think what they were starting to get towards, Kevin Rose was saying, you know, RSS is really important still, but people don't use RSS readers anymore.
Well, Leo said no one uses RSS readers,
let's just say Leo's favorite phrase is no one and everyone. You know, everyone hates AT&T. No one uses RSS readers. No one likes iTunes. That was one of my favorites. Everyone hates iTunes. He said that too. I don't hate iTunes.
Gross generalizations don't go down well with me. if no one uses RSS, then who am I? Or what am I, chopped liver? And also, why was there so much whining when NetNewsWire changed things a few months ago? Now, I know I was leading a lot of the whining, but I wasn't alone in whining.
Yeah, you know what, though? I started thinking about that. And again, so what they were talking about was using RSS readers. And in my regular day-to-day life, I'm not sure I know anyone who uses an RSS reader, including me.
What about me?
Well, I'm sorry. Other than you. But and I do know some of my podcast listeners, you know, we talk about, I think Connor uses an RSS reader, a few other people, you know, I think that does come up. But in my meat space life, let's call it. Of course, in my meat space life, I don't know anybody who listens to podcasts either.
Which clearly there are people who do, because we're not talking to ourselves.
Right. Except for people who listen to mine. I shouldn't say that. My friend Lynn and my friend Namdar loves the show. But he reads it. He doesn't listen to it.
Oh, he misses out on so much of what I have to say because I'm so bad at show notes.
Well, you're getting a lot better, so that's good.
That is actually true. I'm doing a lot more typing.
Yeah.
But no, if it's part of your job or part of what you do to keep yourself informed on a topic, I don't know how I could do it without my RSS reader. I could not possibly visit 300 websites every day, but I can read an aggregated feed of 300 RSS feeds.
Maybe the difference is... So many of us are, maybe there's like a trickle down of the way information gets out. Okay. Someone creates original content somewhere. Mm. And by the way, this is one of my concerns about the death of journalism is who's going to create the original content. Cause most of us are just yapping about what somebody else said.
Well, exactly. It's like, blogs are the future of the news. All blogs do is yak on about the stuff the journalists write first.
Right. And that's one of the things I like about what you and I do is we're generating original content. We're not just talking about, you know, somebody else's prediction about what the Apple stupid tablet thing is going to be. So tired of that topic. But so there's a trickle down, I think. So there's someone at the Wall Street Journal or the LA Times or the New York Times who actually is in a real situation interviewing somebody gets the real scoop. And then they write an article and then somebody blogs about it. And then it ends up, say, on Gizmodo or one of those kind of places. And actually, they generate some original content, too. Mm. And then that gets into somebody's newsreader. And then that's where tweets come from. And I'm at the lazy end of it where I just read the tweet.
I have to say, I mean, I tweet a fair few links, and those links generally come from my RSS reader, and I don't think I'm alone in that. So that's how the stuff gets into Twitter. And once it's in Twitter, you have the echo chamber, and the same tweet gets retweeted and bounced around and, you know, passed on to people. But in order to get into any of these social networks and start bouncing around, it has to be put in there. And I don't think that's from people reading websites. I think that's from people reading RSS.
Now, why do you think that? Because that's how you get it, but why would that necessarily be true?
Well, some people have a website. Like, you know, people, I know a friend of mine who gets all of his news from Blues News and The Register. Mm-hmm. And that's his news source. So, but the people who write Blues News, where do they get it from? How do they aggregate all the different news but all the different stuff coming from all those different sources?
Well, Steve got turned on to Reddit by Kyle, and Steve loves Reddit, and he tweets articles that come from Reddit, but Reddit is essentially doing the news reading for him, right?
Is it an RSS crowdsourcing?
But maybe it's a, yeah. Yeah, so that's crowdsourcing the most interesting articles, say on tech, for example, that he would be following, or science. He's got real into the science stuff, and so he's not using an RSS reader, but he is aggregating it, but it's being aggregated by humans, not by an RSS feed.
Yeah, that's a different approach. It's not really aggregated. I'm trying to think of the word. Sort of curated content.
Yes, that's a better phrase for it. So he's getting interesting articles that if, for example, he tweeted the same picture that you sent out of the, that you were talking about of England, but I'm sure he got that through Reddit.
Mm.
Whereas
I would have got it from the BBC's RSS feed.
Right. So you get it from the BBC RSS feed, and then your comment could end up on Reddit because somebody saw it because you tweeted it. It could end up, you know, kind of going in a circle there. So I think there's different ways to get the content these days.
Sure.
I just hope people continue to generate content, not just pass it around.
Yeah, absolutely, because otherwise we're all in trouble.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, is that I still think there's people who actually use RSS on the front end. Then you have people who use RSS without knowing it. If you tell Facebook to include your Flickr in your Facebook stream, how's that connection made? It's RSS.
Okay, I don't know how to Facebook do what you just said, but...
Well, I hate Facebook, but somewhere there's a button there that says suck in content from my blog or from my Twitter or from my Flickr.
Oh, so it's posting what you do on Flickr in Facebook, you mean?
Yeah, and it does that by simply subscribing my Facebook profile to the RSS feed of my Flickr profile.
Okay, right. I think I've done that because I know when I post my show, it shows up in my Facebook feed, but I've no idea how I did that.
RSS.
Yeah, okay.
You can tell it to use a blog. So I have my blog sucking into my Facebook as well. So I don't actually ever post anything in Facebook, but my stuff magically appears there because Facebook is using RSS to syndicate that information from my other sources. And the only way it can do that is over RSS.
Okay.
So that brings us into this whole Web 2.0 mashup idea. And where does the information for the mashups come from? RSS. If you want to suck lots of content from all over the place and present it as one big thing, you use the RSS feeds to suck that content from the other places.
Okay. But I think the point was not that RSS isn't there and not that RSS is important. It's that people aren't using news readers to get to it.
Yeah, everyone isn't, and that's certainly true. But
there's lots of things Bart doesn't do.
By that logic, everybody's using Windows and no one's using the Mac. And by that logic, the Mac is dead because only 5% of people use it.
Okay, I'll go along with that.
The other thing that you wanted to mention is that I thought all browsers were very good at dealing with RSS, but maybe I'm just spoiled because I'm a Firefox user. When you have NetNewsWire installed, your operating system, if you're using a Mac, definitely, knows that you have an RSS client. So if you click on an email in a browser, what happens?
And my standard email client launches.
Yeah. Well, if I click on an RSS button in Firefox, Firefox asks me, it shows me the content of the feed. So just all the articles, one after the other, after the other. And at the top of the page is a big button that says, would you like to subscribe using, gives you a bunch of websites like Google Reader and stuff, or use my default RSS client. And then I just click the button and it's straight and subscribed in NetNewsWire. So at no point am I copying and pasting in RSS feeds or anything like that. And the button is right in the menu bar. It's not even something someone's put in a page, like that big yellow RSS button that was popular for a while. There's no need to do that. You just put it in the metadata and the browser will look after it.
Huh. I didn't actually realize it would do that. See, to me, I'm still used to seeing the orange XML button and you have to right click on it and say copy link and then go over, open up an RSS reader and say, you know, open and or subscribe and paste. And I think that's where Leo gets into the it's too hard thing.
It certainly is if you do it that way. There's no doubt about that. No one's going to do that. But all I do, I go to the website.
Did you just say
question.
No one? Sorry.
No. So if you go to a page that has RSS, like, say, bartb.ie, you will see that in Firefox, as well as your usual favorite button or stuff at the side, a little orange sort of radio-y looking icon, that always reminds me of the Wi-Fi icon, but on its side, comes
right.
up. There is an RSS feed icon. So it's blue in Firefox, the latest version.
Oh, it is. That's not standard.
And then I can just go subscribe to, and it will pop up and say, so it shows me the page, and then it says subscribe to the feed using, and it gives me a whole bunch of options, and one of which is going to be my default RSS reader, which is NetNewsWire. And hence, it just pops magically in. Safari isn't as good. Safari gives you an RSS button in the menu bar, and you click on it, and it only shows you the feed. It doesn't let you subscribe.
Yeah, that's what... I haven't used Firefox in a while, and that's what I think I was used to seeing.
The other thing that both of those browsers will let you do is if you bookmark an RSS feed, it shows up as a menu in your bookmarks rather than as a single item, and the items in the menu will be the current items in the RSS feed.
Right, right.
So you can subscribe to an important RSS feed like that, and it'll just be in your bookmarks as a folder. So I think it would be a very good idea for people to have the US certs, alerts subscribed like that in their browser so they can keep an eye on the latest security alerts without waiting for me to tell you about it, because I'm not perfect.
Hey, I just noticed, while you were talking, I tested what you were saying about subscribing and I changed it. One of the choices was Google, and I just noticed it gives me a choice of add to Google homepage or add to Google Reader.
Yes, so your Google homepage is one of those mashup sites where every little square is an RSS feed.
Hmm, maybe I'll do that because I might read it there. I did. Yeah, I got lazy and I just said put it in my bookmark. So I read one RSS feed and it's bartb.ie.
The other thing, of course, is mail clients can be RSS readers as well. And every time a new article is posted, it shows up as a new mail message effectively. And when you read it, it shows up as a red mail message.
I did that too for a while, and then I got bored.
it works though. I subscribe to over 200 feeds, so I think it's much more practical to let NetNewsWire deal with it because it's really good at it.
You know, I actually lost where it went. It used to be in here somewhere.
Oh, I don't think it was put back in after your new can pave.
Oh, you have to add RSS as a category in Apple Mail?
If you new can paved. Your mail. If you knew compaved your mail, and you didn't recreate it, why would it still magically be there?
I thought it was a default thing in the left-hand sidebar of mail, like mailboxes, inbox sent, trash, junk. I thought it was like one of those.
If you're not subscribed to any feeds, it's not shown.
Okay.
It doesn't put up. Apple don't put up empty drop-down lists.
Well, that's good.
That's just clutter. The moment you add a feed, it will be there. But until you add a feed, it does the Apple thing and keeps it out of your way.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I just hit the little plus thing, and look at it. Looky there. It just let me put it in. There's Bart, Daring Fireball, and Regator, which is an aggregator of RSS feeds. Now I'll never know. Now I'll never know what's going on. This is a mess. Oh, I never should have done this.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, that's why NetNewsWire is great, because you can be organized about it.
Yeah. Well, I think this has been a good episode. We certainly covered the gamut. We covered weather and security light meets dumb question corner. We had a regular security light, which was very light, and photographing snow and whether RSS is dead or not. We have just declared it alive and well.
As alive and well as it ever was. It's not taking over the world, and I don't think... Well, I'd never expected it to take over the world, and I don't know if anyone did.
Maybe it's taken over the world in a subterfuge kind of way, though. You know, it's under the cover everywhere.
Tool. Well, it's under the cover everywhere. That's no doubt about that. No one can argue with that. But it's also a very geeky tool. It's like Linux is never really taking over the world, but it's very, very much alive.
Right. All right. Well, I think we've covered enough for this week.
Okie dokie. Assuming I haven't frozen into a solid icicle, I'll see you again next week. A Bartsicle. Excellent. Until next time, I think we're at that stage, are we?
Yes, we are.
Until next time, happy computing.
Well, it's that time of the show again where we have to sign off. But remember, there's fun stuff going on all week long on Twitter. If you haven't already done it, follow me at twitter.com/podfeet. And if you're going to Macworld Expo, make sure you send me an email so I can invite you to the NoSilicast calendar for Macworld Expo. It's because we're going to try to arrange a meetup and we're doing all the organization over there. Keep sending me the emails. You know I love to get those dumb questions, the ones you're afraid everyone else knows the answer to but you. But in reality, there's probably a ton of people who have the same question and would really like to know the answer. Send in those emails to Allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.